Welcome to The Mental Breakdown. I'm Dr. Bernie Wilkinson, and today's podcast is going to be about depression, what causes depression, and really try to highlight a little bit about why treatment is important with depression. But first, a couple of announcements. As always, the Handbook for Raising an Emotionally Healthy Child, Part 1, Behavior Management, is available on Amazon Kindle, as is the Elimination Diet Manual. Both are great resources and texts that will help you manage your child's behavior, as well as look to see if diet or nutrition or anything like that is possibly affecting his or her behavioral or emotional or even physical health. So check those out on Amazon Kindle. They're available for immediate download. Been getting some very nice reviews from those. The Parenting Your ADHD Child course is available on paydiallc.com. Go to the show notes of this podcast and you'll find the link to go right to the courses page, and you can see the outline for the parenting course. You'll see what each lesson covers. You'll see that there's some additional resources and other things there that will help you implement many of the strategies that I talk about in that parenting course, and so that you can get it to work right away in your home. Helping you and your child just make things a little bit smoother there at the house. So, all right, I think that's all the announcements. As I said, this podcast is about depression, and I hope that it gives you some information, and if you're struggling with depression, I hope that it gives you the little bit of a nudge that you need to maybe get some of the help that would benefit you in getting through this episode of your life and get to where you want to be, into a happy and healthy place. So enjoy. Welcome to The Mental Breakdown. I'm Dr. Bernie. Today's podcast is about depression. Recently, I was sent some news reports that were some different athletes and different people have been talking about depression. And, you know, this is a problem that I have because I don't watch television very much. I do Netflix and those kinds of things. I watch lots of programs, but I don't really watch TV. So I don't watch the news. I don't do any of those kinds of things for a variety of reasons. But one of the negative consequences, I suppose, of that is that I really don't have the opportunity to see some of the news reports about different things. For example, a couple of months ago, leading up to the current Olympic Games, there was an interview with Matt Lauer and Michael Phelps, and where Michael Phelps was talking about being very depressed and having problems with alcohol and some different things, and this led to him going into rehab and all of this, you know, leading into his fifth Olympic Games. So that means he's been competing in Olympic Games for 20 years. It's remarkable. But, you know, there was that a couple of months ago, and then there was another interview, written interview, column, article, with Allison Schmidt, who is another Olympic swimmer. But there's lots of other people who are very well known who have struggled with depression. NFL Hall of Famer Terry Bradshaw, actors like John Hamm from Mad Men, Ashley Judd, Owen Wilson, lots of different actors and very what we would typically look at as successful people who have lots of resources, maybe who have lots of money and who have lots of opportunities to do different things that most of us have never done and probably will never do. But yet they really struggle with depression. And so the person who sent me some of this recent information asked, you know, Dr. Bernie, how can these people be depressed? You know, Michael Phelps is one of the most decorated, if not the most decorated, Olympic athlete of all time. And he's going into his fifth Olympics and may actually be the oldest Olympic swimmer to win a gold medal. But he struggles with depression, and even in this interview sort of hinted in the direction of possible suicidal ideation and suicidal thoughts at that time. How can that be? How can these people who are otherwise so successful seem depressed, and not seem depressed, but experience serious depression? And so that's what this podcast is about. We're going to talk a little bit about what that is and then where that leads us. So when I think about depression, I consider it from a what they call a biopsychosocial model. So we got biology, psychology, and social or sociology. So we have the biopsychosocial model, and we'll just kind of talk briefly about each of those three. Certainly, any talk about depression or any mental illness, for that matter, could span multiple podcasts over multiple days, if not longer. So this is going to be relatively abbreviated, and if you're interested in knowing more, write to me and send me some questions, and I will, you know, do some more podcasts and talk more about it in a little bit more detail. So when we think about the biopsychosocial model, let's first talk about biology. And so certainly we're just talking about biology, what our body is physically. And more specifically, though, really with depression, as we're talking about biochemistry, there really hasn't been a lot of research to suggest that there's any structural differences in the brain between the depressed person and the non-depressed person. And that should make sense because depression is a mood, certainly, but it's also somewhat of a state of being. But most of us, if not all of us, I think arguably all of us, have experienced depression at some point or another in our life, whether it was something that happened, we lost someone dear to us, or we were going through something really challenging or really, really troubling, and we experienced that those depressive symptoms. And that's a common, a normal, many times, experience, a normal feeling that we have in those times. So it's not like we're talking about, you know, you can look at the picture of a person's brain who's depressed and a picture of a brain of a person who's not depressed and say, and be able to differentiate, be able to say, oh, that person is depressed. So when we're talking about, so we're talking about chemistry. Now, when we talk about chemistry, that's a little bit misleading as well, because we've all heard about the idea of being, quote unquote, chemically imbalanced. They have a chemical imbalance, that's what makes them moody, that's what makes them this or that. Well, there is some truth to that. However, it's not something that we can really measure. You can't draw some blood and send it to the lab and say, you know, is this person depressed? Does this person have a chemical imbalance that's making them depressed? It doesn't really work like that. It's not diagnostic like that. And so when we talk about a chemical imbalance, we're talking about the way that the brain and the body is working, and most of the way that the brain and body works is through chemicals, through the relay of chemicals in different ways. Now, when your brain is functioning, for example, when I'm having this thought to then use the neuropathways that go to the muscles in my face to make me talk and make my hands move while I'm talking, those are all created by chemicals. Chemicals move from one neurotransmitter to another neurotransmitter that makes that neurotransmitter or that neuron fire. And when that neuron fires, it makes the next neuron fire. And it's just a cascade that goes through to make us move, to make us think, to make us speak, to make us understand. All of that is chemical based. So when we say that someone has a chemical imbalance, okay, that's a great thing to say, but it really doesn't have a whole lot of meaning. All of that said, certainly people who are depressed tend to have medical or issues with the way in which their brain is functioning or the volume of chemicals that their body is producing. We all know, I think most of us know, that serotonin has been the neurotransmitter primarily implicated in depression. Well, so we think, oh, well, we'll just give more serotonin and everything will be fine. Well, we are learning that it's a little bit more complicated, or maybe even a lot more complicated than that. So serotonin is implicated, but so are other neurotransmitters such as norepinephrine and dopamine and GABA and glutamate, and just these different major neurotransmitters are also implicated with depression, which is why one medication may work for one patient but not work for another patient, even though they both have depression. So when we're talking, though, about when we're talking about this biological aspect, we know that there are these chemical imbalances, again, grossly speaking, but we tend to always attribute that to the brain. We think, oh, well, neurotransmitters are neuro meaning brain, meaning nerves, which we think of in the brain. Well, what we're now learning is that one of the areas of our body that has the most neurotransmitters is actually our stomach, our gut. Our gut has just as much, if not in some cases, more neurotransmitters than our brain. So when we talk about that gut-brain axis, that relationship between the gut and the brain, we really do mean that there is this connection, because the gut has just as many neurons, or not neurons, but just as many neurotransmitters as the brain. And so when we think again about what the biological aspect of depression could be, it could be inflammation caused in our stomach based upon something that we've eaten. It could be a medical issue that is somewhere in our body that's affecting the way that our body is functioning, that's resulting in this neurotransmitter imbalance in our brain that's causing the depression. It shouldn't be surprising that if a person has a severe medical issue, that is going to potentially result in depressive symptoms. When I was working at the University of South Florida, one of the psychiatrists that I worked with was really interested in working on the mental health aspect, the psychiatric aspect of AIDS. And what he found, of course, is that people with AIDS, it shouldn't be surprising, have lots of issues with mental health problems such as depression and anxiety and stress and those kinds of symptoms. And we know that those symptoms are a manifestation of these medical issues directly sometimes, and sometimes indirectly. So there really is this biological aspect of it. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that medication or surgery or anything like that is the only remedy. It just means that there is a biological aspect to it, and we'll get back to that in just a few minutes. Biopsychosocial, that was the biology. The psychology of it is really has to do with our cognition, our thoughts. Aaron Beck was a pioneer in this area, and he talked about things like cognitive distortions. And he talked about how when we're depressed, we tend to have automatic thoughts that are at the same time negative, distorted, not really based in reality, and absolute. And so we say things like, I always make mistakes. I will never get any better. And so we use these words like always and never, because when we're depressed, we tend to use these kinds of absolutes as ways to broadly generalize a problem that we're experiencing right now. So when you're depressed, as an example, and you fail a test, well, the immediate thought is going to be, I always fail tests. I'm so stupid. I will never be able to graduate. I don't even know why I'm here and trying, because this is going to happen every time. And those kinds of automatic thoughts get going in our brain. And if we don't implement some type of strategy to stop them, that's when we start, when the problems begin to escalate and we really get into some issues with those automatic thoughts and really be at risk for engaging in some actions that can cause problems and serious issues in the future. But those automatic thoughts, as Aaron Beck called them, cognitive distortions, that is one of the main targets for in treatment. And again, we'll get to that in just a few minutes. But with the psychology aspect, we're really talking about those cognitions, those thoughts, those feelings and emotions that we have at the time when we're depressed, that tend to maintain the depression into the, on into the future, and it just keeps perpetuating those symptoms with no end in sight. Biopsychosocial, we had the biology, we had the psychology, and now let's talk about the social aspect. we all know that as humans, we are social creatures. So we have this interplay, this interconnection with ourselves and other people. We, for the most part, most of us are somewhat sympathetic and empathetic with other people. And so when relationships are lost, either because by a choice, someone leaves or we leave, or someone passes away or something like that, in a very real way, a part of us leaves with that person. And so we experience this bereavement and this depression, these depressive like symptoms, grief and things like that after the end of a relationship. Now, the other very fascinating thing I think about depression is that one of the main symptoms of depression is isolation, social withdrawal. So when we're depressed, we tend to pull away from other people. Now, we know that one of the ways to overcome depression is to interact and to be engaged with other people. And so we have this pattern, and I'll talk more about it in just a moment, but we have this pattern where when we're depressed, our body tends to perpetuate that depression by engaging in actions or wanting us to engage in actions, reinforcing us to engage in actions that maintains the depression. It maintains those feelings. So again, with the social aspect, when we know that interacting with other people, when we know that being with other people will make us feel better, make us happier, our depression results in us wanting to pull away and wanting us to stay away from other people. And it's a very fascinating phenomenon that happens when we're depressed. So when we think about each of these three areas, the biological, the psychological, and the social aspect of depression, it's important that we consider that the bottom line is that this twisted effect that depression has on us is that things that would otherwise help us pull ourselves up and recover from depression are exactly the things that are impacted by our depression. So we have no energy when we know that exercising is an important way to overcome depression. We lose our appetite, or where we begin to be hungry or crave sugary sweets and things like that. When we know that good, healthy, vitamin-rich, nutrient-rich foods is what will get us through the depression, we go towards the sugary, simple carb route because, again, that's going to perpetuate. That's going to make us feel good momentarily, but it very quickly results in that drop that will cause more depressive symptoms. So we have this drive when we're depressed to almost stay depressed. So what do we do about it? How do we fix that? Well, this is why treatment is so important. Treatment is so important with depression because if we're not careful, this drive, this propensity to continue down a path that can be problematic is going to potentially lead us in a direction or in an area that's going to make us do things that we wouldn't otherwise do. I've worked with many patients who experience suicidal ideation, and they can tell me, you know, when they're sort of feeling okay, they say, I like life. I want to live. I don't want to feel this way. But at the same time, they admit that when their depression is really at its peak, it's difficult for them not to think about that. So we need to remember that when we're depressed, we are this is the truth. When we are depressed, we feel driven to remain depressed. We feel driven sometimes to allow that depression to get worse. And so again, treatment is so important because none of us want to stay in that state. We all want to get better. When we're well, we know when we feel better, we know that we want to be well, we know that we enjoy life, we know that we enjoy the things that we're doing. And so we have to do something to remedy these depressive symptoms when we're experiencing them. Today, treatment approaches are shifting considerably. In the past, it was medication, medication, medication. Now, most psychiatrists are referring patients to counseling first before they start medication. And that's because medication, most of the medications for depression, those SSRIs and other medications that target serotonin, but also some of the other neurotransmitters, those medications take 2, 4, sometimes 6 weeks to begin to show any efficacy at all. And that's if we have any response to the lowest dose that the psychiatrist would start us on to begin with. So that delay, that amount of time that it takes for the medication to start working, oftentimes is about the amount of time that it takes for psychotherapy to be beneficial for a patient. And so what psychiatrists are doing now, and what's sort of the typical standard, that every psychiatrist doesn't follow this, granted, but the typical standard now is when a patient first presents with depression, we refer them for therapy, psychotherapy first. And then if after a month or two, the therapy is not working, hasn't really shown the benefits that we would hope that it would show, then we refer for a psychiatric consult and then potentially medication. So we're trying to do that, the psychological aspect first, cognitive behavioral type of approach to dealing with the depression. And the reason that we do that, because remember, again, biopsychosocial therapy addresses the psychological and many times the social aspects of depression. And then we may think, well, what about the biological part? We're completely missing that. So if I have a biological reason for my depression, the psychological and social piece isn't going to help that. Well, if you thought that, you'd be a little bit incorrect, or maybe a lot incorrect. Because actually what we know is that changes in behavior, changes in thoughts, changes in emotions and feelings, changes in motivation and drive, exercising and those kinds of things, we know that all of that changes brain chemistry. There has been some fascinating research, and this is just slightly off topic, but it proves the point. There's been some fascinating research in the area of reading, for example. They'll do brain scans of people who are non-readers. And you can see a non-reader, when we attempt to give them a reading task, you can see how their brain is lighting up and what areas are working and what areas are not working very much. And then you can compare that to a person who is an adequate reader, a good reader, and you can do the same thing with them, and you can compare these two brains. Well, then there's no medication for reading or anything like that, of course. And so we put a non-reader through a reading program. We teach them how to read in a way that's going to be beneficial to them. And when they become readers, and then we put them in that same situation and look at their brain functioning changed. Brain functioning is chemistry. The way that the brain is functioning is, in the basic terms, chemistry. So they change their brain through a therapy, through a training to teach them how to read. The same thing happens with depression, the same anxiety, depression, ADHD, all of these things. When we engage in good therapy that shows benefit, and the patient or the person is doing what they need to do to overcome that from a psychological and social aspect, it changes the biology. It changes the chemistry. So when we address depression initially through psychotherapy, we are addressing the biology as well. We're addressing the psychological, the social, and the biology. So we're getting all three. Medication, that's just going to be chemistry. That's just going to be the biological aspect. There's nothing about medication that's going to help you learn how to cope with those automatic, definitive thoughts that trouble people with depression. It doesn't do anything for that. So we go with psychotherapy first because it helps to address all three. Now, it doesn't have maybe as quick of an effect as medication. It certainly isn't as easy as medication. Medication's easy. You just take the pill and you swallow it once a day. Therapy is going to require work, and therapy is a tool that is so effective if you're able to do it. If you're, well, I say able to do it, but I don't mean able to do it. I mean, if you do it. Anything that we talk about in therapy is something that you're capable of. It's just whether or not you do it. That's not to say that because you can't, that you're weak or anything like that. What that means is that sometimes we have to put forth a great deal of effort to make it happen. And that's understandable. That is what we're here for. That's what psychologists and therapists and counselors are here for. We're here to help you work through that so that you can implement these strategies and get better, deal with those psychological and social aspects of it so that you can get to where you want to be, get back to a healthy way of functioning. So the key here really is getting help as early as possible. You know, I was talking earlier about how when we're depressed, our body, our chemistry, everything sort of drives us towards remaining depressed, staying in that state of depression. And so getting help as early as possible in that process sort of makes it a little bit easier for us to work on it. If you start experiencing depressive symptoms, but you don't get help for 4 or 5 months, well, that's 4 or 5 months of that perpetual reminder and reinforcement for staying depressed. But if you got treatment early on, maybe a couple of weeks into your depression, you know, diagnostically, it's a major depressive episode. If you're depressed most days, most of the day, for more days than not, for 2 weeks. So if you're depressed for 2 weeks, okay, that's a major depressive episode. If you get help then, the likelihood of a very quick response to treatment is very good, is high, it's great. If you wait 6 months, it's going to be more challenging. It's going to require more work and over a longer period of time. So if you're experiencing some of those depressive symptoms, you know, get help as soon as you can. It doesn't mean you're weak. It doesn't mean that you can't do it on your own. What it means is that you're recognizing what your needs are. You're recognizing and interpreting your body the way that you need to and getting the help and support that you need. If all of a sudden you couldn't see across the room, you would go to the doctor to figure out what's going on with your vision. Well, if your depression is affecting you in such a way that it's making it hard for you to get up and go to work and do the things that you need to do on a daily basis, why wouldn't you get help for that? It's just as impairing. If you can't go to work because you can't see, or you can't go to work because you can't get out of bed and you have no motivation and drive to do so, the ultimate result is you're not going to work. So why would you get help for one and feel like that's okay, that's legitimate, but not get help for the other? It's just as legitimate, it's just as real, it's just as much of an issue as a vision problem or anything else. So if you feel depressed, even if it's just a little depression, if you look at some of these stories of Michael Phelps or Terry Bradshaw or Owen Wilson or any of these other people who are in the media, who are out there, and we read about them and see them and it sometimes envy their lives, and we see, wow, if that person's depressed, what hope do I have? Seek some support, seek help, seek someone to talk to, someone to engage with, so that you can overcome those symptoms, so that you can work and find ways to manage those symptoms in a healthy way. The skills that you learn in therapy are going to be skills that you'll learn every time you have one of those episodes in your life. Again, we all have them. We all experience them from time to time. Even the most positive person has moments where they're down. And sometimes those moments last for days. I certainly know people who are extremely positive, and I will, you know, if I sat back and really thought about it, there are periods where they sort of disappeared, sort of faded into the back. During those times, those are times when they're down, where they're depressed and sad and low, but then when they come back out, here they are, their normal selves again. So everyone experiences it. Everyone feels those things. And we just need to get the support that we need to overcome them, to deal with them and to manage them. When you do that, when you learn these skills and then you're able to implement those skills repeatedly, well, you know, that's when you really are starting to take control of as much of your life as you can and really helping you to become the you were meant to be. All right. I hope that's helpful. If you're experiencing any of these issues, give us a call in our clinic or another mental health office near you. Get the support that you need. Don't fight it alone. Get help. Help will make all the difference. So, all right. Until next time, I'm Dr. Bernie. Stay happy, stay healthy, and forget to be afraid.